But now on the next portion, I say learning from the mistake. Something was wrongly read into the Bible, namely that two beings are in the Godhead. When Deuteronomy 6:4 was recently produced as evidence that would correct that mistake, those who had held the error did not examine their premises. No, because it's very difficult to examine premises. Rather, they made a second assumption that the new explanation is an attempt to distort the truth. In other words, the original distortion is controlling all subsequent thinking. Those who understood Deuteronomy 6:4 correctly have been accused of blindness, liberalism, unwillingness to take God's word as truth, misleading the church, removing truths which God had inspired Mr. Armstrong to set into the church, etc., and some have left the church so as not to be contaminated with such an error. Those who have left believe that they are the preservers of the traditional understanding. Thus, a third assumption is made, but the question is, who is preserving the traditional understanding? Some people buy it, and they act on it. In this way, the impact of one false assumption is taking colossal dimensions. It is obvious that some have bought the false assumptions and have acted on them, and this brings to mind the vivid principle stressed in the New Testament, "Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindles." James 3:5. Now that brings that point to an end. But let me just say a little more on that so we can clarify the situation. Perhaps we could go to the New Testament. I'd like to say a little more about that example. In Matthew chapter 22, so now let's have a second digression. We digress from the digression now. Chapter 22 and verse 41. Matthew 22:41. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them, saying, "What do you think of Christ?" Now the question is, the word Christ is not a name, is not a proper name, it's a title. What do you think of the Anointed One? What do you think of the Messiah? Whose son is he? They said to him, "He is the son of David." So they were expecting a son of David, which means they were expecting a human Messiah. Now you can read Isaiah 9 and verse 7, and which talks about the throne of David, or Isaiah 11 verse 1, which talks about a rod of Jesse. And they expected a leader like that, the son of David, to come and set up his kingdom, to rule, to expect to expel the foreign armies and make Israel number one. That's what they were expecting. The Jews did not read Psalm 110 and verse 2 as referring to God. When they said, "The Lord said to my Lord," they did not mean one God speaking to another God. The Jews never thought that. They only think of the Lord meaning God himself. The Jews believed in one God. That's why they say he will rule among his enemies. But look at verse 43. He said to them, "How then does David in spirit call him Lord?" Well, is Christ, now the Psalms of David were considered all Psalms of David, irrespective of who penned them. In the book of Psalms you will find some of them who are written by Asaph, or to Asaph, or some of them are written to David and by David. Now, if you look at the Septuagint and find out how many of the Psalms are written by David and how many are written to David, you're going to find only a half a dozen that are written by David. It's very, very difficult. You know, if you look at the Septuagint, you find the superscriptions, they say, they follow the Hebrew text. The Hebrew text says, Le David, which means to David. But this word also means according to David. Or it could mean of David. But of David meaning
a psalm of David or a psalm that speaks of David.
So this is an ambiguous statement. Does it mean a psalm of David or a psalm that speaks of David? In the Hebrew language is ambiguous. Ambiguity is rampant in Hebrew. It's the nature of the language. And the Septuagint people, when they translated it, they said a psalm to or about David.
A psalm about David. It does not say a psalm of David.
Now, of course, that's what makes me say that Christ took that. He says that this part here is irrelevant. In the discussion with the Pharisees, he's saying, look, this is not the time to discuss who wrote and who didn't write this. This is not the time to discuss authorship. This is the time to make a different kind of point. And the point that Christ is making is that he is not happy with the name Son of David, because that's too little. He says, I am not only the Son of David. Look at, go back to chapter 21 and verse 27. And they answered Jesus and said, we cannot tell. No, I'm looking at the wrong verse. Verse 37. Yes. But last of all, he sent unto them his son, saying, they will reverence my son. So Matthew then is interested in conveying this one point, that Christ is not only the son of David, he is also the son of God. But in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 20, it says, but while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, fear not to take Mary, your wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. So Matthew, even from chapter 1, wants to get across the point that Jesus is not only the son of David, but he's also the son of God. And that pervades the thought of the argument of the gospel. We have to realize that the gospel is an argument. A gospel is a sermon. A gospel is a presentation of ideas, right, with a particular audience in mind, and he wants to make it. And this is not the point to discuss who wrote the book of Psalms. So the question then is not who wrote the book of Psalms, but what title does the book of Psalms give to the Messiah? And Christ is saying in that particular passage discussion with the Pharisees that the title that is given to the Messiah is My Lord. Not only he doesn't say My Son, but My Lord as well. Now, the Jews, when they read Psalm 110, well, let me start with David. Let's suppose somebody wrote the psalm and gave it to David. And David says, oh, I like this psalm very much. Let's put it in the collection. That could have been that could have happened that way. So, in one sense, by including it, David is saying, he is accepting the title, My Lord. If David wrote the psalm, that's fine too. Then he had a human person in mind when he said, the Lord said to my Lord, whoever that might be, still one God. So I'm not making a big issue about that one. You can take it any way you like. But you may want to there are passages in the New Testament which refer to the Psalms without giving credit to who wrote them. Let me find one of them. In verse 30, in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 35, that it might be fulfilled that which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things which have been kept secret, and so on. The prophet here is Asaph. It's a psalm of Asaph, but no credit is given to him. Anyway, I don't want to pursue that line of thought. The point I wish to make is that Jesus Christ did not say that David was speaking about him. He didn't say, look, David is speaking about me. He's just asking a question regarding the Messiah. And the point is that the Messiah is not only the son of David, but also he is the Lord of David. So Christ was correcting the common misconception regarding a conquering Messiah. He was saying to the Jews, yes, the Messiah will come, but not with armies to restore the throne of David, with many Davidic conquests, but with a divine mission. He'll be the Son of God as well. So he will come with the love of God to save mankind. If you want to verify this idea about of and for, and if you want to look it up in some commentary, you may want to look at the Sonsino commentary. I have it here. Let me read it to you. It quotes various rabbis. Rashi explained this passage on these lines. But Ibn Ezra found it unacceptable and named David as the king, maintaining that the superscription signifies a psalm for or concerning David. The same view is adopted by Chief Rabbi Herman, and so on. It goes on like that. So you want to, if you're interested in looking that up, you can see the Sonsino commentary or the Anchor commentary. Let me read that to you, the comment as well. At the time, the Davidic authorship of the Psalms was unquestioned, though parts of the Psalter predate David, and parts of it are exilic and post-exilic. David was regarded as the patron of temple music, and the musical guilds may well have owed their origin to the time of David. And then quote, Albright and other people. So that takes care of Psalm 110, verse 1. There is one more passage regarding the plurality of the deity in the Old Testament. And that is Daniel chapter 7 and verse 13, where it says, I saw one like the Son of Man, who came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days. So the argument goes like this. Here are two beings, the Son of Man and the Ancient of Days. 1 + 1 = 2. But the principle is that we have to read in context. Verse 1 of that passage says that we have a dream and visions. And verse 7 speaks of night visions. And verse 9, he says, I beheld until. And verse 13, he says, I saw in the night visions. There is a difference between two beings and a vision of two beings. And you cannot argue that because Daniel saw a vision of two beings, that there are two beings. You cannot take a vision and understand it as if it was a photographic description or presentation of God. If you do that, then you have a mistake. Now, you can, let me give you a biblical reference so you can know where to go and prove it if you have to. Look at Revelation chapter 5 and verse 6. And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne and of the four beasts, and in the midst of the elders, stood a lamb as it had been slain. Now, of course, we know the Lamb is Christ, having seven horns and seven eyes. Now, if you take a vision in literal terms as a real description of what God must look like, then you know what this Lamb looked like. He had seven horns and seven eyes. But that's not true, because later on he says, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. So, visions of God are used because of their definitive content. They carry some kind of spiritual reality or lesson. And if visions are to be taken like photographs, then we make mistakes, because we confuse symbolic language with real issues. And in Daniel, the point is symbolic. In other words, the throne signifies judgment. The judge is dressed in white because of righteousness. Among the Jews, white had a meaning. Among the Romans, it didn't. So, I think the white on the American flag means truth, I think. The Son of Man and the saints, all that is a messianic passage. It's not proof that God wears clothes or sits or has white hair. In fact, you can look at Daniel chapter 2. I won't read those, but where Daniel says, here is the image, and here is the dream, and here is the interpretation. You know, there is an interpretation to come with the visions and with dreams. It's not enough to take them as they stand. Similarly, in the New Testament, we have the passage of Transfiguration, where Christ appears to the disciples, or shall we say the disciples had a vision in which they see Jesus, Elijah, and Moses. but Elijah and Moses were dead. So visions must be interpreted. You cannot take visions at face value. Therefore, you cannot conclude from a vision that there are two divine beings. That is the argument. Now, of course, with Daniel and the Lamb, the question comes up all the time. He says, why don't you read Revelation chapter 2 as well? Well, so let's read that one. Every time we go through that passage, they say, well, you didn't read chapter 2. And verse 13 or 12. I saw seven candlesticks, 13, and in the midst, one like unto the Son of Man. Here is the Son of Man again, clothed in a garment down to the foot. Now if we take it literally, then does God wear garments? Who made the garments? So if you say God made the garments, then God doesn't need garments. So, that's it. I mean, that settles it. And girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool. That has significance. As white as snow. And his eyes were as a flame of fire. And his feet like unto fine brass, as if they turned in a furnace. And his voice as the sound of many waters. These are symbols. They are not. There isn't anybody who has a voice like many waters. And he had in his right hand seven stars. All right? Take it literally. If you want to take it in a literal sense, then in his right hand he has seven stars. Which is, now we are getting nonsense out of it. And out of his mouth went a sharp, two-edged sword. Now, wait a minute. If you're going to take it literally, then you have to say to me, out of his mouth goes a real sword. Well, that's not what it means. It means a figure of speech. We've got to interpret these symbols. But what do people do? They say, oh no, wait a minute. He has the white hair. That is a real description of God. He wears clothes. Yes, he does. He sits on a throne. Yes, he does. But the sword, oh, that is a figure of speech. So, in other words, they provide their own interpretation, and they say, well, you are wrong because you don't agree with mine. See, they pick and choose whichever they like. The truth is, all these are symbolic. So even if you read chapter 2, you still come up with the same answer. And if you read the scriptures literally, when you read in Psalm 82 and verse 5, all the foundations of the earth are shaken, then I wonder what you're going to do with that. You know what's going to happen if you shake all the foundations of the earth? Be terrible. Now we come to the end of this part, so let's look at handout number 11, which is steps in the argument. We are now completing part 2 of the presentation. And I'd like to go over these conclusions to make sure that we are together and we have we understand the significance of each conclusion. And notice that I continue the numbering. So we begin with the fundamental concepts, explicit comments, what is in the Bible, and implicit what we are discussing. Beginning with God is spirit, John 4:24, and implicit meaning we're discussing the nature of spirit. Question 7. Does just anyone know what spirit is? We want to say yes, yes, and we all do, but no, we don't. Because the Bible does not say what spirit is. So the Bible just gives us the essence. It says that's enough. If you say God is spirit, that's not just anyone knows what it is. We have to think about it. Number 8, is spirit a substance? And then I put the rest in parentheses, because a substance means with extension. And I wrote the other one in small parentheses because extension means spatial. This is part of the strictness of the language in theology. Is spirit a substance? The answer is no, it isn't. And that's where the mistake was made originally. We took a word, or I say we, but you know, really in Mr. Armstrong's understanding, that's what took place. A word that excludes a substance was taken as a word about substance, from which a conclusion was drawn that since we have substance, we must have a body, and since we have body, we have shape, since we have shape, we have size, we have form, and so on and so forth. Number 9. Strictly speaking, is it correct to describe God in terms of extension? No, it is not. I say strictly speaking because I distinguish theological talk from ordinary, everyday usage and references in sermons and Bible studies. So is it correct to describe God in terms of extension? No, strictly speaking, it is not correct. But if you are a child, if you are don't understand it, by all means do talk the way you normally do. Explicit, man is of the earth, earthy, and implicit, the nature of man. Is man solely matter? The answer is no. God breathed into him the breath of life as well. 11. Is man solely spirit? The answer is no, he is not. He is also of matter. Strictly speaking, is it correct to describe man's body in terms of extension? The answer is yes, because it is matter. And what is matter has extension in space. Explicit now. God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1. Implicit, the nature of space and time. Is God somewhere? It depends what you mean on that point. If you mean, is God in some spatial, if you mean, is God spatial, the answer is no. If you mean, is God, does God affect everything that exists, the answer is yes. But then God is everywhere, not somewhere. So, is God somewhere? No, he is not. He is not. He is everywhere. 14. Is man's spirit somewhere? Again, no, it isn't. Is God in time? No, he is not. Does God have a past or a future? No, he does not. These are little boxes that human beings find themselves in, not God. Explicit, God is one. Deuteronomy 6:4, implicit discussion of the nature of God's unity. Is God a limited one? As a complex, is one. No, he is not. So to say God is one apple, that's wrong. Or like one in a physical sense or a spatial in extension, he is not. Is God an unlimited one? Yes, he is, without limits of any sort. Is God one in an arithmetical sense? No, he is not. Can there be two divine beings? No, there cannot be two divine beings. How much time do we have? We have now finished part 2, and we can go into part 3. Shall we do that? Yes. All right, we are back now on part 3, which will deal with God's oneness in the Old and New Testaments. I would like to make some some comments which will be in the form of repetition. So let me begin by saying that in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, we have the word Elohim, which I already have pointed out. The word Elohim is constructed with a singular verb, bara. Bara, this means, in English it's translated created, but that is not quite enough. Because the English word created does not tell us whether it is singular or plural. And that may be one of the areas of confusion, because people think, oh, if this means gods, or sometime, or two beings, that's how they think. You can still make it read two beings created. That's the point I wish to make now, that you cannot read it that way. That's reading it in English. And the word bara in Hebrew does not simply mean created, but singular. He created. So if you translate it two beings he created, that is not English. So you cannot think of the subject of this verb to be plural. Cannot be gods or two beings. It has to be God, one being. He created. So, bara. So, in the beginning, God created Elohim, bara. That shows that God is one. Now, the word Elohim we saw earlier can be constructed with a plural verb. Now you have something similar in English in the word sheep. You can say the sheep. I saw the sheep. It's not clear whether you mean one sheep or two. If you said the sheep could be sold, again, you cannot tell whether it's singular or plural, one or many. But if you put is or are, then it becomes clear. So the word sheep in English is somewhat similar to the word Elohim in form. The word Elohim can take the verb is or the verb are. So let me erase this and put down Elohim is or Elohim are. When you say Elohim is, you mean God. That's always the case. Now, it doesn't have to be. It could be. It doesn't have to be a true God. It could be God, true or false. Well, that's enough. That. And are refers to angels or angels and God. Or it can refer to human beings, usually judges, people of power. Because the word Elohim is derived from a root, which means power. And in the Septuagint, that word is translated the mighty ones sometimes. Whether that be angels or judges. They are the mighty ones. The powers that be. Now, here in Genesis 1, we say, God created. He created. He created, and that's the Masoretic text. Masoretic text
means the Hebrew Bible. Now, in the Septuagint, I put the word Septuagint means 70, so I wrote the Latin numeral 70, says, uses the verb oiesen, which means he created. Right. So, in this respect, it's the same as the Hebrew, which shows that the Septuagint is correct in the translation of that verb. Now, you may ask, why is it then that the English doesn't try to copy this kind of thing? Well, because the English Bible was made to read well in English. When they made a translation into English, they made it to be read in the churches. That's why some Bibles say to be read in His Majesty's churches or something like that. And I pointed out earlier that the omission of the dual number in Greek is significant. At least Hebrew cannot tolerate a duality of beings, even in expression. You cannot use the words. The word Elohim does not take a dual form. In Hebrew, some words are singular. Some words are dual in Hebrew now. Now, this is a discussion of words. Some words are singular, some words are dual, and some words are plural. So, with that in mind, they use the singular verb for God. Now, in Greek, all words and all verbs can take singular, can take dual, and can take plural. Even so, the Septuagint and the New Testament use the singular, the same as here. I am saying that the Jews who translated into Greek had a beautiful, beautiful device in their hands, the ability of the Greek language to express a dual number with reference to God if they wanted to do that, and did not take it because it is not true. That is not what Elohim means. It does not mean two beings. It means one being. So the Old Testament is strictly monotheistic. And the Christian church relied on the Old Testament for its study. Now, I hope we realize that the Christian church did not have a New Testament. The New Testament was written much later. But the New Testament church read the scriptures of the Old Testament in the Septuagint version, and therefore they would have access only to monotheistic concepts. Now, if you ask a New Testament Christian to explain Christ, he will say to you, exactly what do you want to know about him? You could not ask, is he a part of God or is he not? If you said, what is Christ? He would say, well, he was the Son of God. He performed wonderful works. He died on the cross, was resurrected, and so on. He would also enumerate a number of physical characteristics, like he was the son of Mary. He was born under the law. You read that in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4. You may get something that reflects Paul's approach to Christ, the one he
mentions in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 16, where he says, God was made manifest in the flesh. You may get that. Or you may get John's concept that the Word became flesh, chapter 1, verse 14. But if you were to ask a New Testament Christian, or the Apostle Paul, or the Apostle John, or anybody else you like from that time, how God became manifest in the flesh, or how the Word became flesh, you would get no discussion. Because the concept is foreign. Theological concepts that we are discussing now were not developed in New Testament times. You would get something like a statement regarding the oneness of God. You would get a statement regarding the importance of being baptized in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. But you would not go into any of the issues that we are discussing today. Because these issues were not a part of the New Testament church, neither did they belong there. So you may say, when did the questions arise? The first questions arose when the gospel went outside Palestine. In Mark chapter 16 and verse 15, Christ says, go to all the world. To all the world meant at that time to the Greek world, where the Greek language is spoken, where people thought in a different way. It's important for us to understand that. Sometimes we get the impression that everybody in New Testament times thought the same way as we find in the Gospels, and that is not true. When the first Christians went out to preach outside the confines of Palestine, we find sparks flying. For example, the Apostle Paul goes to Athens to teach the unknown God. But there, he does not make much headway with the Athenians, because they expected a different kind of presentation. They expected a systematic expounding of a sort of a thought regarding God. And they didn't get that. Now, I'm not saying that Paul was not successful in Athens. I'm not saying anything of that sort. Because I do not think we should measure success in terms of how many people are converted. That's not what determines success. We are not even called to determine that kind of thing. If Paul was guided by God to speak in Athens, that's it. He was guided to speak in Athens, and he spoke in Athens.